You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The world is filled with many questions, such as, did giants exist?
What is junk DNA? Does it mean that you're trash?
Do you ever wonder if aliens have underwater bases in our oceans and that's why there are so many UFO sightings off the coasts of islands all over the world?
How serious even is climate change and when should we start building our rafts?
Hello everyone, you may recognize me as Gabby from the History of Everything podcast.
And my name is Bruna, and you don't recognize me from anything yet.
Together, we're two scientists who explore the answers to these questions and many, many more in our new podcast,
Mystery of Everything,
available everywhere you get your podcasts.
Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Monster Talk's a proud member of the Airwave Media Podcast Network, home of such shows as The Accidental Creative, Big Picture Science, and Legends of the Old West. If you'd like to advertise on this show, contact sales at advertisecast.com. Legends tell of an ancient terror, a snake so deadly that nearly every aspect of it is lethal. It's the focus of ancient zoological speculation, medieval alchemical recipes, and as fierce opponents in fantasy gaming and literature. Probably the most famous recent example comes from Harry Potter and the Chamber of Secrets.
There are many fearsome beasts that roam our land. None is more deadly than the basilisk. Capable of living for hundreds of years, instant death awaits any who meet this giant serpent's eye. Spiders flee before it. Ron, this is it. The monster in the Chamber of Secrets is a basilisk. That's why I can hear it speak. It's a snake.
But by the time we finish this episode, you'll understand why, if I had a pet basilisk, I'd probably name it Glance Armstrong.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today we're going to be discussing what's probably the most overpowered monster we've ever tackled on this show. We'll be talking about the ancient legend of the basilisk and the weird modern take on the idea that ties into philosophy, game theory, and artificial intelligence. It's a wild ride, and to be honest, I don't think I've ever learned so much while preparing one of these shows. I edit the show for a regular feed because we have a lot of people who listen with their families and have children, or who are themselves young subscribers. Our Patreon feed usually has more swearing left in and the occasional bit of body humor. I've made a lot of cuts in the free version this week to bring things down a little bit, but even so, I feel like I have to slap an explicit tag on this episode. This is largely for biological reasons. It's also because some people might be concerned about information hazards. For that reason, even in the free feed, I've decided to not beep out the language where it is left intact. I think, even with the edits, you should probably treat this episode as not safe for work. Okay, that's enough warnings. There's some rock-solid science in this episode and a ton of fascinating links in the show notes. If the contents of our discussion inspire you to do further research, there's where you can get things going. Let's get on to some...
Monster Talk.
Karen, I've been wanting to talk about basilisks for a long time.
Me too, so we're not typical people.
No, I know.
Our bucket lists are very strange.
They are. I was looking at our emails. It's like I was thinking about doing this episode in 2017, 2018, 2019, and so on.
So the time has come.
Let's talk about basilisks.
Yes. I mean, there's so much ground to cover. A lot of stories and beliefs and claims all interwoven into this topic. It's
yeah,
really
and a lot of changes in scale over the history.
Got that one in very early.
Yes.
So let's start with a description. What is a basilisk?
When I think about basilisks, it reminds me very much of the chupacabra, which in the sense that when the chupacabra was originally reported, it was a cool little humanoid alien thing. It was really, it had spikes on its back. It was really mysterious. It was tied to UFO lore. Mm-hmm. And then over time, it turned into a hairless dog, which is, I'll be honest, not that interesting. And I like the ones that are like people are speculating that they're alien pets, not, you know, not a dog with mange. I mean, for us as researchers, it's a little mundane. But the basilisk is kind of like the inverse of that. It starts out as a snake. They called it the king of serpents. It was supposed to be a small snake, maybe, I don't know what 12 fingers in length is, but that's one of the earliest descriptions. Time for a finger insert. The term finger as a unit of measure has had many meanings, which is unsurprising considering how integral hands are and how humans typically interact with the physical world. I'll put a link to it in the show notes, but depending on when and where the term's used, finger can refer to the length of the finger or the width of the finger, and from its use in bars as in a finger of whiskey, to measuring cloth or textiles, to its long use in ancient medical texts, it can mean a lot of different kinds of measurements. Later in this episode, we'll hear it translated to mean roughly an inch, but it could be, depending on use, anything from roughly 3/4 of an inch to 4 inches in length. So, the original basilisk legend was speaking of a serpent relatively humble in its overall size, but enormous in its lethality. But it's super, super venomous. Like, the one thing that never changes is the basilisk is one of the most lethal monsters in your bestiary, or possibly bestiary, depending on how you want to pronounce that.
It's got a much longer history as well than the chupacabra.
This thing goes back a long time. We're talking Pliny the Elder. I mean, this is old. Yes. It's an old legend. Mm-hmm. It's an old monster.
And then some crossover, too, with other monsters, which we'll get to.
Yeah. And so, originally, it was a snake. Now, they called it the Serpent King because on its head, it had something like these little protuberances that made it into look like a crown.
Oh.
If it looked at you, you died. Also, and this is kind of important, if it breathed on you, you died.
Or if you touched
it,
you. Or
yeah, if you touched it, by the way, if you touched it, yes, you died. It's very dangerous. I mean, I love the legends about it because it's like everything about it is lethal. Like, it's just the most lethal thing, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
But it does start largely as a snake. I mean, it's treated as a kind of snake. It sounds really like a cobra almost. One recurring theme I think we'll come to in this episode is this idea of euhemerism, which is, I love this. It's the idea that that legends, myths and legends probably have a real thing at their base. Like there's a real thing at the root of them. And right. And we
a kind of grain of truth.
Yeah. And like, you know, I think about how many times we as sort of monster researchers, paranormal researchers, we go in with what I like to think of as the presumption of sincerity, that whatever is being reported at the root of it, it's probably not a hoax. it's probably like there's probably an explanation, right? That's more fitting in the natural world, right?
Right, right.
And so I think there's an urge, like there's an urge to like say whatever this legend is, there's probably a natural explanation. But maybe not. I mean, maybe that's something we should push back from. Like, I mean, you think about, we talked about blimmies, like the people with no heads who have a face on their chest. I mean, okay, that's probably not a real thing. It's possible. Never. These are just made up.
With the basilisk, then, is it about the same size as a snake, or is it smaller, larger? Does it come in different sizes?
Well, they said 12 fingers, and I don't know if that means length to length or side to side, but I mean, not a big snake. I mean, not a big snake. Although over time, it becomes associated with really big snakes. Like it becomes a giant snake. You know, I think it's because they call it the king of snakes, people want to tie it in to the idea that it's also large. But much like the Mongolian death worm, which people always picture it being like a worm from Dune. But in the actual lore, you know, 2 or 3 feet big. I mean, it's not big, you know.
Right.
So, but it does it does sound a lot like a cobra. It really does sound a lot like a cobra.
Yeah, it does.
Yeah.
How are they allegedly created then? Because I believe there are several theories.
Well, so something happens. So in the original stories, they sound like a snake, right? But over time, the story changes. And in the Middle Ages, the stories about them change and their appearance changes. And in some ways, they become conflated with another monster. So so the original way they'd be created is they're just a snake. So they're going to reproduce through eggs. But there was, I mean, even like back in the time of the Romans, they were thinking maybe there was something like, okay, so like I think it's the bird, the ibis, which is common in Egypt. The ibises eat snakes. And so people were afraid that if you ate an ibis egg, for example, that it would like make, it would kill you because ibises eat snakes. So therefore their eggs would be toxic, which is just not true. I'm not suggesting we all go out and have an ibis omelet, but that's just not a real thing. So somehow in the Middle Ages, and I think a lot of this is tied to alchemy because alchemy, remember long ago we did an episode on the homunculus and
I absolutely do.
And it's got one of my favorite episode titles ever, which because the homunculus was created by, at least in part, by masturbating into a jar and burying that jar in a pile of dung. Everybody seemed to think that dung had some sort of progenitive power. I don't know why, but
that was back in Monster Talk episode 53, Onan, the jar burying.
Yeah, I think that's because, well, like soil as well, there were theories at that time that a woman's womb was almost like a garden and that sperm would basically be, well, the seed would
be
planted in her garden. So I think dung or soil is a kind of similar theme for any kind of creation like that.
And dung also stays warm it if you have big piles of it. Because it goes through biological processes of being digested by bacteria, so it generates heat. And I mean, it is possible to, you know, have like hay stacks and dung stacks and this sort of thing to burst into flame if the weather's right. So
yeah, but I think that homunculus is such an interesting idea. I know that that's not what we're talking about, but when we think about modern day IVF and just developments in assisted reproductive technology, I think that's a kind of early version of that, you know, creating human life outside of the body.
Until the, I guess, microscopy kind of like showed otherwise, that would be...
Antony von Leeuwenhoek was an early advocate for microscopy whose research helped bring the field to fame. He was a Dutch businessman and an amateur scientist, and I'll put a link in the show notes if you'd like to learn more about him.
They learned that, like, you know, they're looking at everything that they can that's small. And, you know, one of the things, you know, when you're examining small things, why not look at some sperm? And, you know, there was an expectation that there was a tiny person in there and then like that person just grew, you know?
Yes. Yeah. I think there were, you know, theories that I think that there were little people in ovaries.
Yeah.
Or that there were little people in sperm.
Yeah. Yeah. And so, as we now know, that's actually like half the genetic information comes from the mother and half the genetic information comes from the father. But these theories are happening in a time when there is a lot of confusion. I mean, there are the idea of the monster as being a chimera, like the idea that things, the creatures that are not related at all could crossbreed, right? You know, I don't want to get into how centaurs might be formed, but
we still believe in that.
Exactly. They do. People do still believe in that. But I mean, this idea that species could just crossbreed that are not even closely related at all and produce interesting results. So what happens is the idea of the basilisk becomes somehow involved with the idea that it is parented by a rooster who lays an egg. And then that egg is placed in a dunghill and it's incubated by a toad. And eventually, and that some people would add that it has to be at certain astrological periods for this to work. You need that because otherwise
that makes sense.
It would explain like, well, I tried all this and it didn't work, you know? So, you know, that's, you probably got the astrology wrong. Anyway, that, which may sound ridiculous to us right now, but it was being printed up in alchemical texts and which is strange, right? Like why? Now a lot of alchemical texts are confusing and allegorical because they use codes because they were trying to hide what they were doing from other people. Now, but I don't think that's what's going on here. I don't think this is more like the homunculus where there's an alchemical formula and you're buying your important textbook because you want to like be a super nerd in the, you know, 1400s or whatever. And you get the instructions. Okay, I'm going to make myself a basilisk. Let me see. I'm just going to start by getting the egg of a rooster.
Well, in some cases, too, I'd read that it was incubated by a hen. So in some cases, it was a toad. Yeah, it gets a little bit confusing.
Yeah, there's just a little bit of inconsistency. But let's talk about these rooster eggs. This was the first point where I'm like, why would they think that? Like, it seems like a weird thing to think. So
even more rare than hen's teeth.
Yeah, you would think so. Except, unlike hen's teeth, you know, we've talked about this too. This is so fun. We've talked about a lot of stuff on Monster Talk.
Weird stuff. Yeah.
The hens and roosters have the genetic instructions to make teeth, and what we learned from one of our interviewees.
That was back in Monster Talk episode number 17. Monsters from the lab
was that you can turn on the genes and actually produce hens with teeth, which is tied to like that Jack Horner dinosaur project where he wants to sort of re-engineer dinosaurs by changing the genetics and like reverse engineering them from birds. Like, so like just slowly work backwards to get back to a dinosaur, which is an interesting idea. But I've seen that movie. So there's two ideas about rooster eggs, which I think are very interesting. So this idea that a rooster might lay an egg, the first idea is that there were real things known as rooster eggs, and there still are. And what these are, in folkloric terms, it's the first eggs laid by a female chicken that come out like it's their very earliest eggs, and they are small and weird looking and they don't have yolks. So if a hen lays one of these strange looking sort of failed attempts at an egg, they called them rooster eggs or cock eggs.
Oh, okay. Because hens start laying eggs from a very early age. I think it's about 3 or 4 months.
Yeah.
You know, and in some ways, sometimes they can even have virgin birds. I believe that they don't fare terribly well when they, you know, actually have an embryo that hasn't been fertilized. But yeah, that is possible with some birds.
Yeah, that's called parthenogenesis.
Parthenogenesis, that's it.
Like Athena being burst full form from Zeus's head, Parthenon.
Yeah, chickens can do that, and I believe
several few other lizards can do it.
Yes, but not always terribly successfully.
Occasionally Jewish ladies.
Yes, once or twice.
Anyway.
Speaking of which, go and check out our episode of Monster Talk Live, where we talk about Marian apparitions.
That's right. The irony is not lost on me that in order to explain parthenogenesis with more clarity, I find that I must perform an insertion. Parthenogenesis comes from the roots parthenos, which means virgin, and genesis, which means creation. So literally, it's a virgin creation. Once again, my comfortable sense of understanding was rattled while working on this episode. I thought that a female vertebrate that produced an offspring without a male partner would necessarily make a female offspring, because where would the male chromosome come from? But I was wrong. Some parthenogenesis can produce male offspring. In fact, I found a journal article in Nature about an experiment that produced parthenogenic offspring, some of which survived to adulthood, and produced a sexually diploid rooster. And I believe this means that the rooster had two full sets of sex chromosomes, as it would from a normal two-parent fertilization. I am grossly unqualified to explain the mechanics of that, but regardless, I found it quite interesting. Famously, such asexual reproduction seems quite common in certain lizards, including big monitor lizards, and suggests that they may have the ability to single-handedly colonize new territory with one adventurous female at the genetic helm. Snakes in zoos have also been known to perform this kind of reproduction. The other kind of thing that can cause a rooster egg is that roosters and hens are very similar to each other, and occasionally a hen will have a genetic defect or a hormonal defect and stop producing the female hormones and start overproducing male. And what will happen to her?
It can happen in humans too.
It can. It absolutely can. And what happens is that all her female characteristics start to fall away. She'll develop externally. She'll start to look like a rooster. She'll behave like a rooster, and in some cases can still lay eggs. So she will be very male in her appearance, but can still lay eggs. And that may also be a possible explanation for what a rooster egg could be. Or a third option would be, it's a way for the alchemists to hint at each other, wink, wink, this is bullshit.
Yeah, that it's a code for something else.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
But while researching this, I learned something really weird.
Oh, it's all weird.
Well, it's all pretty weird, but this is one of those things that, like, you know, okay, at this point, as I learned this, I'm 52 years old, and I felt like, honestly, up to this week, that I had a pretty good grasp on animal biology. I mean, I've watched a lot of documentaries. I've read a lot of biology books. And I was very surprised, Karen, to learn that roosters don't have penises. Meanwhile, the ducks have penises that are like longer than their body length.
I found out recently, too, that female birds just have one working ovary.
Oh, really?
So a lot of them have two ovaries, but only one is functional. And that was, I think, to facilitate flight in some birds. But I think chickens only have one working ovary.
That's a hard-working ovary. That's a
absolutely, yeah, because they pretty much lay an egg a day.
Now, admittedly, the chickens we have today are not like the chickens of medieval times, right? I mean, they've been bred.
Apparently not, if you go and look at illuminated manuscripts.
Yeah. No, so just, I mean, they've been really, really, really bred and conditioned. And largely, that's an American innovation. The American hen breeders really worked hard to make giant chickens that produce a lot of meat. I mean, you used to, you know, chicken's a stew animal. Like, you can get a lot of meat off of them, but, you know, it's not like now. Now, you know, a chicken's like a little turkey. I mean, they're huge.
And with some of the commercial farming, too, the way that they gear birds to think that it's summer or spring all year round. When they're, you know, in cages and with bright lights, and so they're laying eggs constantly.
So it turns out 97% of birds species don't have penises. That's a lot fewer penises than I expected. That's
yeah, I was not aware of that.
Yeah, I mean,
we know some pretty weird stuff, but that is
yeah.
Indeed,
but I mean, that seems like worth mentioning. Also, a lot of reptiles don't. I mean, see, the thing is, I knew about cloacas, right? So, so cloacas have, you know, that's a single excretory orifice that handles reproduction and solid waste. And like birds, like when they poo, you know, it's a, it's like they don't pee and poo. It's all like one liquidy mix, right? It's, so it all comes out the one hole. But what, so like for roosters,
no one's eating dinner while they're listening to this.
I hope you're having chicken and eggs. So, so roosters actually reproduce through what they call a cloacal kiss. So the male and the female, basically they go face to face and they join their cloacas up. And if everything's working well, the rooster will pass sperm off to the hen. And, but it's, it seems like a very discreet transaction. I mean, I've seen these birds reproduce and somehow didn't know. I mean, there's a bunch of feathers and, you know, there's some busyness going on, but I didn't realize that, that that's what was going on. I thought there was a penis involved and I feel cheated.
Well, I've heard too that a hen can be inseminated for up to a month, that they can store semen and sperm for that period.
That's pretty common in the animal world to store semen. I love the octopus because it will accept the sperm packet from the male and then just hold on to it till it's ready, you know.
Thousands and thousands of babies.
Yeah, and bees will, you know, the queen gets her donation early on and then basically uses that for the rest of her mating life, I mean, for her reproductive life.
Yeah, they're doing better than we are.
Yeah, I mean.
But I have to ask, all of this chicken bird reproductive science, what's that got to do with a snake?
Somewhere in the Middle Ages, this idea that a rooster egg could be incubated in a dunghill by a toad. Why a toad? I don't know. Like it's
all like warty and witchy and
yeah,
nasty.
It's all very peculiar. Yeah, I did a lot of reading for this episode and nobody bothered to explain why a toad. But they also didn't explain why roosters don't have penises. So, I mean, I had to do a lot of side research on this
one. Yeah, you've just got to take a lot of this at face value. But yeah, I don't know if you've actually mentioned the name of this hybrid creature.
Sorry. Yeah, so over time, in the Middle Ages, the basilisk has changed, in case you haven't caught up to this, from being just a basilisk to being more of a cockatrice. Those terms are basically used interchangeably in the Middle Ages.
It's confusing at first, though. Yeah.
It really is. And the imagery of the animal has changed because now that it's formally called a cockatrice, it's presented in drawings and descriptions as being much more like a snake-rooster hybrid. And so it's
sometimes
like
even a dragon.
Yeah, it looks like a wyvern. And so it's like a wyvern is a two-legged dragon. And of course, so not a true dragon with four legs, and not an Asian or Chinese dragon with, you know, the long skinny body. But so this is a classic two-legged wyvern type animal with bat wings and then a rooster's head. These are all artists' interpretations because obviously if they looked at it, they would die. So, you know, they're just guessing.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. Just add to some confusion here because the first time that I'd heard of a cockatrice was when I was studying medieval history, and I had read about this being a particular dish, a food. And so I hadn't heard about it as being a cryptid or some kind of monster. But apparently there was a practice in medieval times where they would cook the front end of a fowl and they would attach it to the back end of a pig.
Oh, it's like a turducken.
Yes, I guess an early version of that. But yeah, so it wasn't with a snake. I mean, I don't think that was common practice to be eating snakes then in England anyway, but to mesh it with a pig.
Yeah,
that's adds a level of complexity, I think, to the
It does, it does. Although everything is better with bacon, right?
Not for everyone, but... So what are the historical records of these creatures then and folkloric references too? Because they are mentioned in such a wide range of literature.
Yeah. So in the first century, they're mentioned by Pliny the Elder. And he talks about them in a lot of the terms that we understand now. So if you see their eyes, you die. They say it's about 12 inches long. So I think that's the interpretation, that 12 fingers is 12 inches. That they have white markings on their head and look like a crown. Mm-hmm. Their sound can kill other snakes. Like its hiss can kill other snakes. Its touch can scorch the grass. So he has a lot to say about it. And he also talks about his natural enemies, which we'll get to.
Right.
It's also mentioned in, I don't know if it's Lucan or Lucan in the first century, which talks about it. It's mentioned in the Bible.
Yes. Yeah, as the cockatrice, isn't it? Or is it?
It depends on which version you look at. It's interchangeably. Mm. Some versions use basilisk, some use cockatrice. Yeah. And some use dragon.
And it's mentioned in Shakespeare too, I think several plays.
And obviously in many medieval alchemy texts as well. So,
oh, and even Canterbury Tales, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales. So,
yeah,
and I think that Leonardo da Vinci had mentioned
he did. The creature as he well. Did. Yes, he did. Yeah, it's quite a lot. I mean, it's a very commonly believed in monster,
mm-hmm.
which you would think would be weird because, I mean, why would they believe that this crazy creature could exist? And I think that maybe comes down to the question of like stories about when we run into them, so which we can get to.
Yeah, and I think, I mean, who knows if everyone who wrote about these creatures believed in them or whether they were reporting them as folklore. It's really difficult to tell. Ooh. I mean, in Shakespeare, it seems more literary than necessarily a belief.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, Shakespeare makes all kinds of allusions to various creatures and spirits and folklore.
Mm-hmm.
So,
oh yeah, yeah.
And he's a poet, so he might be speaking poetically. And of course, they're going to roll into figures of speech if people believe in them. You know, as dangerous as a basilisk. You know, mm-hmm. Also the alchemists. And as I should have mentioned this too, they didn't just like mention these creatures for no reason. They mentioned these creatures because part of their alchemical processes included taking basilisk skin and using it for its reagent properties, which included the ability to create sort of a fake gold. So it could make copper look like gold, which is, you know, handy.
Yeah, that was one of the core beliefs of alchemy, wasn't it? Turning base metals into gold.
Yeah. So they didn't say that it could literally make things into gold, but it can make copper look like gold, which is not bad.
So the basilisk and the cockatrice, however you prefer to refer to it, do they have any natural enemies?
They have a few. I guess this is the continuing feature of what to do if you run into a monster, right?
This is important information.
That's right. So the first natural enemy is the weasel. This kind of ties into the idea that they're similar to cobras. The idea that there would be a mongoose or a ferret or a weasel, something in that that family. Yeah. These are mammals that have a high resistance to toxins and do predate on snakes, like, frequently. That's part of the folklore. In addition to the weasel or ferret or mongoose-type predators, also known as the ichneumon, the basilisk was also said to die if it was exposed to the crowing of a rooster. This was alluded to in the Harry Potter series. At this point in my discussion with Karen, I needed to talk about ancient theories about how eyesight worked. My original explanation was a bit muddled, so here's a briefer and more accurate version. Explanations of how eyesight worked were once torn between those who believed vision was created when we shot rays out of our eyes and those who believed that particles shot into our eyes. And these warring camps were known as the extramissionists and the intromissionists. You've got the Platonic and Pythagorean camp on the first side, and Democritus and others on the latter side. Aristotle seemed to have hewed closer to our modern understanding, but the idea was still hotly being contested well into the Middle Ages. I've put a link in the show notes about this debate, but current vision theories are built around the idea that light receptor cells and brain interpretation are what creates our vision, which sentences the basilisk's so-called death gaze to the realm of magic and fantasy.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about. The stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or say Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and WagOn.
Everybody shush! William Shatner has something to say.
Cat and Jethro, box of oddities.
What do you do when the woman you love dies? Well, of course you dig her up and you live with her.
Aww.
The show examines weird things.
There are plenty of old photographs from this time period of children out in the streets playing in and among the dead horse carcasses.
Oh, I miss those days. Things used to be so much simpler.
Cat and Jethro.
Then there's the urine wheel, which sounds like a really bad game show.
They've done weird things. Cat and Jethro, box of oddities. That is really mysterious.
Join Cat and Jethro Gilligan Toth for the strange, the bizarre, the unexpected, as they lift the lid and cautiously peer inside the box of oddities.
The Webby Award-winning Box of Oddities podcast from Airwave Media.
If the idea is that its vision, like, literally shoots out, you know, death rays. Mm-hmm. It makes sense that one of the defenses you can use against it is a mirror. If it sees itself, it kills itself.
Okay.
Which, again, this whole idea that in order to create them, you have to go through this complicated alchemical magical process makes sense, because if they reproduce normally and were not allowed to, like, if they saw each other, they would kill each other. That you'd have to, how do you make them, right? I mean, like, it makes sense that it
dangerous
would,
stuff.
Obviously, you need a toad and a pile of shit. So,
all natural conclusion.
It just makes good sense. So, but that's the most common ways to get rid of them.
Well, I've heard of some stories where soldiers or knights would attempt to kill them, and even when they were dead, that they could still spurt out.
They're really dangerous. Like, okay, for example, one of the stories is that a guy with a lance kills one by piercing it with a lance. The poison just shoots up the lance and then goes onto the arm of the knight and kills the knight too, and the horse. Okay, they're very lethal. In Dungeons and Dragons, they have, you know, both the basilisk and the cockatrice. They both exist in the D&D world. And they basically made the basilisk like an eight-legged lizard, and the cockatrice looks like a wyvern with a rooster head. But both of them, they are not even close to being as lethal as the actual folklore. Dangerous critters.
So are there any other ways to kill them?
Those are the ones that were listed, like in the folklore that I saw. I think the main thing is you don't want to run into one of these things. I mean, they just getting near them kills. In fact, if we talk about some of the history around, like, actual cases, they start to sound like something different.
Right. Well, we can start talking about that, about whether they're mythical or historical.
There's a couple of real historic, well, real is probably the wrong word. There's a couple of historical records.
In a loose sense.
Yeah. There's historical records about stories about these animals being encountered. And probably the most famous is the Warsaw Basilisk of 1587. We've had Mike Dash on the show before, and I love his research. He's got a great article talking about the Warsaw Basilisk of 1587. And I'll put a link to that in the show notes. It's from Smithsonian. It's a fantastic article because it sort of addresses this idea that I talked about the sort of the dangers of euhemerism.
I read that as euphemism, but
so basically, but the short version is there's a house in Warsaw in Poland, mm-hmm. and a little girl has disappeared, and they're looking for her, and her mistress is trying to find her and sees her in the basement of this old abandoned building, and she goes in to get the girl down in the cellar. And then she falls down dead. Mm. And then other people come, and then someone else falls down dead. And ultimately, they realize that something horrible's down there. They realize it's a basilisk. And so they come up with this idea of sending someone in wearing mirrored armor, protecting them. And so they end up getting a guy who's sort of a convicted bad guy. He'll be pardoned if he survives his encounter, and he goes in and successfully kills the basilisk, and and then they're able to get the bodies out and that basically frees it up. That's a real building. The building is still there. There's a restaurant now called the Basilisk.
Oh, how apt!
Yeah, but it's a strange story. Like, I mean, the guy who has the missing daughter, his name is Makeropeus, which is like a Latinate name. And so here's the risk, I think. I think as a skeptical investigator of monster stories, these things happen. The basilisks lives in caves and cellars, okay? Mm-hmm. When people go in to investigate, they fall over dead. What does that sound like? Like, to me, it sounds like a gas leak. Like there's like, a natural gas leak or something, and the people are running out of oxygen and dying. And it's easy to say, oh, people go in and they fall over dead. There's a monster in there.
That is an interesting idea, especially since this seems to appear across cultures and across time, if there is some kind of common thread there. I mean, that's an interesting theory and might be the case in some cases.
Right, it might be, and it certainly could. I mean, like, if you're just starting to say, why do people believe this myth? You know, the idea that a poisonous gas is being emitted not by the ground, but by a beast that's living in the cave. That makes great folkloric sense. Mm-hmm. But in this particular case, that's not what's going on. And I think it's really interesting. Like, I really recommend people check out Mike Dash's article. I'm going to spoil it, though, because we don't have time to read his whole research and it wouldn't be appropriate to do so. Sure. But there's codes in the text that make it clear that this story is actually about a humanist, and it's about this humanist movement at the time. So the idea that there's a Latin name would have been inappropriate for Poland at the time, right? So
it's 16th century.
It's like this is actually a text about something else, and it's about using science and other things. It's not a story. It's not a literal story about a monster. It's much more hooded or concealed story. It's got Rosicrucian elements. It's got a lot of interesting stuff going on. Yeah. So
it sounds it. I mean, all of this is so complex.
It is complicated. Yeah. It's very coded and it's complicated. And I I'm probably not doing a great summary here, but it's more like there's this text that describes a monster, but there's hints in it that it's actually an allegorical story about something else. But now people get the story and they're like, look, there was a basilisk in Warsaw. Mm-hmm. It's a real thing that happened, but it's not, that's not it. You know, it's, you need to know the historical context. And I think Dash does a great job as always. I mean, I really like his research. Mm-hmm. He does a great job of saying, look, you need to understand what this is coming from. So,
yeah. Look, lots of things going on here.
Yeah, and the other case happened in England, and I have screwed up and not put the link in my show notes here. Oh, sadly, at this point, I couldn't recall the legend of the Renwick cockatrice, but it is so brief that I'll just insert it here. The 1794 work titled The History of the County of Cumberland recounts the story of why one local estate owner didn't have to pay church tithes. It seems that about 200 years before, his ancestor was said to have slain the cockatrice and was thus exempt from tithes. However, the folklore around the story is quite muddled, and a separate story about a cockatrice that was inhabiting the ruins of a church had become hybridized such that it's now common to read this all as one single narrative of an ancestor who became a hero by taking a spear from a rowan tree and slaying the loathsome winged beast and thus freeing his family from an obligation to pay tithing. Paranormal Cumbria, a 2012 book by Jeff Holder, has the most thorough collection of origin material I've been able to find on this legend. A link is in the show notes. Those are the two big cases I'm aware of. I'm like, so you've got these historical references, then you've got a couple of medieval cases where they talk about actually having a basilisk show up. And these stories are very similar, where it involves, you know, a cellar or a basement or a cave. And again, it really does remind me very much of a poisonous gas and like using that as an explanation. But again, I think there's other things going on. So
could have even been a case that did occur somewhere and then was transported to England or to Poland.
Yeah, it's also true.
Urban legend. So yeah, it's hard to get to the bottom of this, but I think it's interesting to talk about just all the layers of this story. These stories.
True, but we talked about that with the Beast of Gévaudan. Is like it appeared in France and had real historical, you know, corpses piled up, you know. But at the same time, it was being retold in England as kind of mocking the rural peasants of France. And similarly, I think some of these stories get like one country's tragedy is another country's mockery, you know, like that kind of happens too. So,
oh, yeah, a lot of rivalry going on then for sure.
Absolutely.
But are there any real basilisks in the animal kingdom?
You're talking about the Jesus lizard.
Isn't it a great name? Well, the common basilisk.
Yeah, the common basilisk. These are fascinating lizards. These are lizards in the New World.
Why is it called the Jesus lizard?
Because it can turn water into wine, Karen. No. Wouldn't that be handy? No, yeah. Because they can run on water. They you may have seen these in commercials and documentaries. These are crested lizards, so they do have that sort of regal crown that was, you know, talked about in the original basilisk lore. But what these lizards do is when they're scared or frightened, they run away and try to get across water, but they run on their hind legs. They've got big webbed feet and they run so fast. They literally run across the top of the water. It is stunning.
They remind me a little bit of the Australian frilled neck lizard, which we used to have on our 1 cent coin, but they run in a similar fashion. It's very cute.
It is cute. It's amazing. I mean, I'm sure it's extremely effective. And I mean, you see it. I'd love to see one in real life because I've seen them in slow motion. I've seen them at regular speed and they're just stunning, but
incredible.
It's got to be amazing to like accidentally spook one and it just runs across a creek or something. You know, that's wow. Yeah. That is so neat.
Yeah, they're very cute. But what about other animals that could have possibly inspired the basilisk as well? I mean, you've kind of spoken about a few.
Well, the cobra, types of snakes. I mean, the cobra sounds the closest because like the spitting cobra and the king cobra, they both rear up. But I mean, the thing that kind of disqualifies them is, we know that, like, even in ancient Egypt, they knew exactly what a cobra was, and they incorporated it into their regal headwear and stuff. It was like a religious symbol for
hieroglyphs.
Yeah, exactly. So they knew what cobras were, and that's not a basilisk. So, you know, I'm inclined to think the basilisk is an entirely mythological folklore creature that's kind of a conglomerate of different ideas, and over time, it's just evolved into a nonsense chimeric animal, but they have been in our folklore for, you know, more than 2000 years. I mean, so, there's fascinating stories about them. So, I mean, they've rolled into pop culture and they're weirdly underappreciated and underrecognized, I think, because, if you say basilisk, I think most people probably don't know what you're talking about, yet they've appeared in some, like, you know, really interesting intellectual properties.
Yes, and we'll get to pop culture in a second, but you just made me think, too, of Genesis in the Bible and the reference to the snake and the Garden of Eden. Do you think that there's any possible link there between that snake and the basilisk or not?
I don't think so. The serpent in the Bible is interesting because it starts out as the most beautiful animal in the kingdom, and then it's punished by having its legs removed mm-hmm. and turned into like it shall crawl on the ground. And that I find that story of Genesis so fascinating because, you know, if you read it literally, like a lot of, like when I was, you know, grew up in the church, in a fundamentalist church, you know, I was told to take it literally. But if you step away from that and
I never have been.
Well, I know. But if you step out and go into like biblical, not like you could look at the Bible as literature, or you can look at the Bible as a biblical scholar and use textual mm-hmm. analysis. And it seems mm-hmm. like that the Bible, like at least the book of Genesis, is actually a combination of multiple creation myths, which is just fascinating. And there's multiple ways of reading the story of Eden, which I can't stop thinking about. So one of the most common ideas, especially in the past 50 years, is this idea that like that we are on the verge of an apocalypse, and that Jesus is coming back soon, and everything's going to end, and that all the evil are going to fall into hell, and the you know there, some people are like they believe in that the Christians will be or the believers, the faithful will be lifted up into heaven, and there'll be an age of tribulation, and some people believe it'll all just come to an end. There's a lot of interpretations, right?
But, sure. Yeah.
But what I find fascinating is the focus on this idea of the Luciferian, right? So if you go back and look at the story, it's not that clear that the snake is the bad guy. I know that sounds weird, but it's not that clear. Like if everything's God's plan, right? Mm-hmm. How does the snake become associated with Satan and Lucifer and Beelzebub? Like what's happened is over time, this complicated story has been simplified and smushed into there being like a good guy and a bad guy, and that's the whole story. And it's actually mm-hmm. probably more complicated than that. Like originally it was more complicated than that. Like, but over thousands of years, the story has gotten muddled, which is, you know, I'm not here to talk
subject
about faith.
For maybe another
yeah,
show.
Exactly. But the most fascinating interpretation of that story, the one that just haunts me, is this. What if this story is not about people falling from God's grace, but it's about escaping from the simplistic world of the garden? So, in other words, if you think about it, it's a lot like the story of Prometheus, because the tree that they're not supposed to eat the fruit of is the tree of knowledge. And so basically, once they eat from the tree of knowledge, they're forced to no longer have everything handed to them. They have to leave the garden and learn how to survive in the world. Like literally everything that we have accomplished as a human species happens because of knowledge, because of our ability to accrue knowledge and learn. And so in that sense, Lucifer, as his other interpretation is Lucifer Lightbringer, is like really metaphorically powerful. But even so, that snake's not Lucifer. That snake is the serpent. I mean, that's literally what it's described as. And so, these are all mashed up ideas, but...
Oh, yeah.
I mean, it's
a lot of that
incredibly complicated ideas. And so, you know, in lots of ways to interpret it. And I know that some people take it very, very literally, but I can't escape that fascination of sort of seeing this as more of a Prometheus story, and somehow the thing that freed us from this simplistic world is actually the thing that made us this world we live in now possible. I like this world. I mean, even with the pandemic going on, I think this world's pretty cool, and people are able to do all kinds of interesting things. So, you know.
Yeah, well, it's all about perspective, I guess. But we should treat this in another show, I think.
Yeah, maybe.
At least the basilisk, and I think we should talk about pop culture, because I think that most people would know the basilisk from a particular series of books.
You're right. You're talking about the Harry Potter books, right?
Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm,
indeed.
And really, there have not been a lot of basilisk representations in pop culture, but the Harry Potter one is a biggie. I mean, they do appear in the Dungeons & Dragons books, as, you know, even the earliest versions include both the basilisk and the cockatrice as separate mm-hmm. monsters. But the Harry Potter series has the Chamber of Secrets. The secret is that there's a basilisk living under Hogwarts, you know. Sorry, spoilers.
if they haven't read it by now.
And not only does it turn people to stone, but it also it has incredibly potent venom, which they use later to kill Horcruxes, which are the things that... wow, I know too much about Harry Potter. I should probably stop. But
you do, but it seems to be a different beast in some regards. It seems to be a lot larger.
Well, it is larger, but there are basilisk stories. there are basilisk stories that make them into giant serpents, because it goes back to that king of the serpents. This idea that because it's super powerful, maybe it should literally be a giant snake. You know, and you and I covered the giant snake lore and the idea that, you know, the snakes can get quite large, but except in prehistoric times, there's never been a 50-foot snake. Like 30 feet seems to be just about as big as they can get these days. So
big enough.
Which is big enough. Exactly. It's huge, right? You know, and you're not likely to encounter a 30-foot serpent. That's probably the maximum that you could probably run into. But even so, there's no snake alive today that kills with its breath, kills with its vision, makes all the birds fall dead, and then kills all the other snakes nearby, and can turn copper into gold. I think it's safe to say that the basilisk in folklore is a non-existent monster, but a fascinating one, which I think the world is richer for having as part of our human lore.
It really is, but you wanted to tell me too about a modern basilisk that seems to have scared a lot of people a few years ago.
Yeah, I've been trying to get this onto the show for a long time, so I think I'm excited to actually talk about this. So,
you have the floor.
In 2010, there's a website out there called Less Wrong, and it's a website that discusses philosophy, artificial intelligence, game theory, lots of really interesting sort of intellectual ideas. If you're into that sort of thing. I'm actually weirdly, like, I like philosophy, but not my thing. I mean, you know, maybe at a coffee shop, you know, on the occasional, you know,
like a bar.
Yeah, a bar. Like, yeah. I mean, yes, there's occasions when I think it's fun to discuss, but I mean, man, people can get really caught up with themselves. And that, I think that's the dangerous downside of philosophy is, too much navel gazing is hazardous to your social life. I don't know, but I like it. But this user on the website, Less Wrong, named Rocco, wrote an idea down. And basically, he hypothesized something that's become known as Rocco's basilisk. Now, if you're the kind of person who thinks that AI is eventually going to come to pass in the sort of Star Trek sense, or that there's going to eventually be artificial intelligence that are like people and human companions, and they're going to be just like another living person, and that's something you firmly believe in, and you believe in the singularity.
Right. That's what I was thinking of.
You might want to stop listening, honestly, because you might actually be frightened by what we're about to talk about. I don't, this has become known as an information hazard. The idea that an idea itself can be dangerous. Personally, I'm very skeptical, and to the point that I'm very comfortable talking about this. But I understand the impulse. And so here's your chance to drop off and go watch something else or listen to something else. All right?
Run away! Run away!
Are the scaredy cats gone? Okay. I'm going to assume that they are. We're going to move on.
All right.
So what Rocco proposed, and I'll put links to this in the show notes, it's this idea that it's possible that in the future we might create an artificial intelligence that is designed to benefit humankind and be sort of an all-powerful artificial sentient entity that is capable of doing just about anything, all right?
Okay.
And among the many things it can do is it can look at the existing people in the world and it can figure out who among us knew that it was possible for this creature or this entity to come into existence, and who among them worked to help make that happen, and who among us did not? Okay.
Mm-hmm. And consequences.
And consequently, it could punish the people that didn't help it. And so Rocco's idea was, if we know this thing might come into existence, it's mm-hmm. in our best interest to work towards its eventual creation. Because if you don't, it might be able to punish you for not
vengeful.
Having helped out. Yes, it might be vengeful. And so you risk, if you don't help create Rocco's Basilisk, if you don't help create this AI, you risk mm-hmm. the possibility of being tortured. And not just tortured in this life, but potentially it will have the power to create copies of you in an artificial world and do nothing but torture you for all eternity. Now, I think there's some real holes in this idea. I just want to say that right now.
Really?
Yeah. Well, like a reasonable person is going to have to be able to accept the idea that an artificial intelligence could be created, which mm-hmm. which has the power to discern who helped it and who didn't.
Right. Right.
Okay. And then to somehow exert control in the real world to make this person suffer. No, I don't believe that at all. Like, I think there's so many problems with this idea. Okay, but here's what happened. Rocco posted it. He posted his thing, and it freaked out people on the site. Now, the guy who runs the site is Eliezer Yudowsky. I hope I'm pronouncing his name correctly. Okay. He got very upset at the whole thing. I mean, he posted a very angry rebuke to Rocco and deleted the post.
Mm.
But he now says that the reason he deleted the post was because, not because he thought Rocco's Basilisk was real, but because it's harmful to post information hazards, even if they're not real. Like, it's a bad idea. Like, there are ideas that are dangerous and you shouldn't be posting them. Right. And so it's malicious. Right. And so he's written some very lengthy explanations for why he got mad and yelled and deleted mm. stuff. Right.
Mm-hmm.
At the original post, I can sort of see that maybe that's what he was saying, but it looks a lot more like, oh, my God, what are you doing? You crazy person. Like, you know, let's not spread yes. this idea. Of course, trying to suppress an idea is one of the best ways to make the idea spread.
Yeah, and to make himself a victim.
Also true. So what happened, though, is like in 2014, I think it was Slate and a few other sites started running stories about Rocco's Basilisk. And they wrote it like it was a real hazard, right? And so it's created more existential angst around artificial intelligence than is probably warranted, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think pop culture makes artificial intelligence seem like something that is, first of all, inevitable, and B, will be something that we can understand, as in it'll be like us, right?
Yep. When we can fathom.
Yeah. And the best case scenario is like the one on Star Trek, where you ask it questions and it politely follows your instructions, right? So even there's all kinds of, you know, problems that show up in the series around artificial intelligence. But here's the thing. We don't know what intelligence is. We don't know what consciousness is. And we aren't capable of simulating things that we can't first quantify. So there's no current risk that we're going to create an artificial intelligence like us that turns out to, like us, be malicious and vindictive. That's just not possible because we can't model a thing that we don't even understand, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that's part one. And part two is that we don't have the computing power, or even close to it, to do the kind of thing that's being discussed here. Everything we do now exists on machines that require electricity and maintenance and humans. And even if like we somehow merge robots with our best artificial intelligence, they're not going to be autonomous. They need our help. They're not that powerful. They aren't able to go make electricity. They're not able to make hands and feet. They aren't able to interact with the corporeal world in that way. They could mess up our data, but that's about it. I mean, they can't, like, they don't have robot agents out here, you know, doing stuff. Like, that's just not, you turn off the electricity, you turn off the problem.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
So that's,
but I guess it's just one idea of one perspective of AI, but it also makes me think about Pascal's wager a little bit, that there's kind of that to it. That
it is, like, I mean, if you think this is real or could be real, it's absolutely in your best interest to work towards the creation of this artificial intelligence.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you don't want the negative consequences. But I mean, as a, like a reasonable person working in IT, I can see we're not even remotely close to this. Like, I mean, I know there's lots of people who think that the singularity is coming and they're going to offload their consciousness in a machine. You don't even know what consciousness is. You can't back up a thing that you don't understand into a machine, because that's not how it works. People need to understand that the human mind is far more complicated and weirder than any simulation can manage. I mean, for example, like, during your day, you're not largely a rational being. You're largely interacting based on your biology needs. Like, you're hungry, you're thirsty, you're horny, you're bored. Mm-hmm. Like, all these things drive your behaviors, and they have nothing to do with rational outcomes. And computers, a computer wouldn't understand vindictiveness because it doesn't make any sense. Like, why be vindictive? Like, that's an emotion. Like,
human quality.
Yeah. So who would bother to program greed or lust or vengeance or jealousy into a computer? It doesn't make any sense. Like, it just, even if you could, why would you? Like, so, I mean, this is not a flaw in the AI. It's a flaw in humanity that we like to imagine ourselves onto everything else we run into. So it's fascinating, but it's just not a real thing to be worried about. There's lots more real world stuff, like, you know, basilisks.
Mm-hmm. No. Everyday stuff. But it's an interesting subplot to this.
No, it's topic. Fascinating. It's fascinating.
Well, you've got one final point, and I have no idea what you're referring to here. But what has all of this got to do with Elon Musk, if anything?
So this cracks me up. I this is so you know, I have some kind of condition around wordplay.
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. So,
in and out of rehab.
Yeah. I've gone to pun counseling and
failed. Primal pun therapy.
The way I came across this cracks me up. So I had this joke in my mind. You've got Rocco's basilisk, and that kind of suggests a joke of Rococo basilisk. So Rococo is this super ornate art style architectural movement. Like, if you look at the Versailles Palace in France, or, you know, Donald Trump's apartment, this giant, like, gold and filigree and like all this stuff, that excessively ornate stuff is Rococo. And
shabby chic.
Well, I thought Rococo's basilisk is a funny joke. Let's see if anybody's already made that joke.
Oh.
Guess who? It turned out Elon Musk.
Good company.
Yeah. Well, Elon Musk was going to make the joke. And Elon Musk decided to do the same thing I did, was see if anybody else has made the joke before he makes it.
Oh, that's amazing.
But so he goes to see who's made the joke, and allegedly he finds out that the Canadian musician named Grimes made the joke.
Oh, was that?
Uh-huh.
I get it. That was how they met.
Exactly. They met because of the same wordplay. They met because of a joke about the basilisk, Rococo's basilisk. So so apparently what I've learned from all this is that I should be in a three-way with Grimes and Elon. That's what I've learned. That's probably not the right lesson.
Yeah, but it appears to be the case.
But seriously, though, I think
is bizarre.
It is very bizarre. So I, when I found that out, I was like, "Oh, you got to be joking me!" But no, that's really true. And you know, Elon Musk is a very controversial person. He's Times Man of the Year. And it sounds like the two of them will not be staying together, although they have made a baby whose name
you cannot pronounce.
I cannot pronounce, exactly. So, good for them. I mean, for all their other faults, at least we all share the same wordplay, right?
Yes. That's a really interesting way to end the show. Wow, I didn't think it would go off on some of these tangents.
You know,
sure.
I love it. Yeah, yeah. So if we learned anything, is that roosters don't have penises, but ducks are really packing some heat.
Well, yeah, we keep coming back to that.
Yeah. So, seriously, preparing for this episode has altered my world because I was
rabbit holes.
It took me a couple of days to come to grips with. These birds don't have penises. I mean, that really is weird to me. How did I get to be this old and not know that? That is so weird. So weird.
Well, yeah, I think you've helped out a lot of people in the making of this show.
Yeah, so I hope that I have...
We're all enriched for that knowledge.
Filled in a lot of empty spaces.
Yeah.
So, all right. Well, so that concludes our initial coverage of the basilisk.
And yeah, it was about time, not before time. A lot of requests for the topic too, and so I'm glad that we've treated this topic.
Me too. Me too. They have no penises. They have no penises.
And I guess this will be the first regular podcast episode for the year.
Yeah, Happy New Year.
So yeah, Happy New Year to you and to all of our listeners and viewers.
Likewise.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, it's gonna be a fun one. Lots of monsters this year.
Indeed.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to a discussion of the mythological beast known as the basilisk. Our show notes are full of further reading links if you'd like to learn more about the material that led to this episode. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindles so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk's theme music is by Pete Stealing Monkeys. Thanks for listening and for your positive reviews. Your endorsement is our very best and most effective way of growing our amazing Monster Talk audience.
Been a Monster House presentation.